Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How do you do ministry with people who don't look like you, sound like you, or think like you? In this episode, Lewis Center Director Douglas Poe speaks with thought leader Reverend Jasmine Smothers about insights for doing effective ministry outside of one's native culture.
This is Doug Poe, Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Reverend Jasmine Smothers, the pastor of Atlanta First United Methodist Church. Jasmine, welcome to Leading Ideas Talks.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This morning, we want to start with just a question asking about what are you reading right now, or what have you read recently that is shaping your thinking on leadership?
Well, I'm reading Canoeing the Mountains right now by Todd Bolsinger, and it is a book about adaptive leadership and how we try to fix adaptive problems with technical solutions. And he tells a story of Lewis and Clark and how they thought once they got over the Mississippi in a canoe that they could get through the rest of the country easily, but they came across mountains, but they didn't have any equipment for climbing mountains. So it uses that metaphor as a way to teach us about leadership. Highly recommend it.
Wonderful. So after you finish it, are you going to have your leadership also read it, or will you use it to teach in some manner?
I will. I've started talking about it already. And the way I have my leadership team set up at my church, I have an executive team, and our primary purpose is skills development so that we can lead in the church well. And so we will read that together and talk about how it might inform the way we're leading at the church. I got it. I serve as a part of the commission on the way forward for the United Methodist Church, and it was recommended through that work. So it's been quite helpful.
Well, good. And the other question, just to get us started, is who sticks out in your mind as a mentor in leadership for you and why?
Right now, I'm learning a lot about leadership from the members of the commission and people like Tom Berlin and the moderating bishops, primarily because of the way they are leading under a great deal of stress and how they are really modeling for the entire church how to be a non-anxious leader, and how to be an adaptable leader, and how to be a relational leader. And that's really informing the way that I am leading right now.
You used the term non-anxious leader, and I hear people use this term often. How would you define that term, non-anxious leader?
Oh, let's see. Defining the term non-anxious leader would be a leader who, under a great deal of stress, and who comes into an already anxious situation. You know, the situation is anxious. They are able to, just in their presence, bring a sense of peace and calm and stability to a situation in which they could be quite reactionary, but instead choose to be proactive and faith-filled and forward-looking.
I think that certainly would be a form of leadership that would be helpful for most leaders in congregations today.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Let us move in a different direction. And I want to talk with you a little bit about being appointed outside of the context of sort of that you grew up in ministry. And we're going to talk about sort of cross-cultural appointments in terms of race and age, and particularly for you, of course, you were appointed or are appointed right now to a place that it's very different for you in terms of race, but also in terms of age. And people, of course, experience cross-cultural appointments in very different ways. But can you share some of the story of Atlanta First and how you came to the church, and then sort of what it was like to be appointed into a context that was different from what you grew up in a church?
Sure. So I'm 15 months into an appointment as the lead pastor at the historic United Methodist Church in downtown Atlanta, Atlanta First United Methodist Church. And I am its first female, first African American, and youngest lead pastor in its history. And I served there out straight out of seminary as the associate pastor, and was the first African-American and youngest associate pastor in its history at that time, and then left for about 5 years to serve on the conference staff doing work around congregational vitality, and then came back in July 2016 as the lead pastor at Atlanta First. Atlanta First is actually Wesley's Chapel in Gone with the Wind. It's the first Protestant church in Atlanta, and it has seen many, many, many years of different ways of being in ministry in the city. It is a church that has primarily in its history been an Anglo congregation, and it has been a very elite congregation. And over the past 30, 40 years, it's undergone a great deal of transition, very much like our city has, and has not really been able to been as adaptive to and responsive to the changes in the city in such a way that it could be in fruitful mission with the city consistently over those last 30 or 40 years. The church has historically been very active in the medical community in Atlanta. It helped, it had a hand in helping to start Hugh Spalding Hospital and Grady Memorial Hospital, which are our community's big trauma facilities now in our public hospital. It also helped to start some of the first child care programs in Atlanta. Some of its congregation had been the forerunners of PTA in the state of Georgia, but it has not done as well around issues of race and racial reconciliation in the city. And so all these years later, here I am coming into a really transient congregation. Congregation that is very interested in redefining its identity and finding a way forward for its new story in the city of Atlanta.
So, given what you just talked about, why do you think congregations and pastors struggle with cross-cultural appointments?
Oh, I think it's just because we fear what we don't know. And when we enter situations that are unfamiliar to us, they require us to change. And change and transformation, while at the heart of the gospel, tend to be very difficult for human beings. And so everything that is new and different, we either have, I believe we have one of two responses. We either rise to the occasion and see it as an adventure, like Lewis and Clark, or we get stuck and paralyzed. And we're not real sure what to do, and we react, and sometimes we get angry. Sometimes, you know, we lose our way. And so the primary issue for me is how do we talk about and live change in such a way that is transformational and not scary and to be avoided?
And I think you make a good point there about how do we sort of live into making it transformational, not scary. So what are some practical ideas or ways of preparing a congregation to being open to a cross-cultural appointment? Because it seems like if you can do that, that could help it not to be so scary.
Yeah. I think cross-cultural appointments are bad when they're forced upon congregations and when we have no tools around them. The Atlanta First congregation has the benefit of a deep and abiding legacy and understanding that if we don't change, if we don't become a part of our community in such a way that it is natural to us to be a part of our community, then we will no longer be the church and we won't be there. And so there are some forward-thinking leaders there who want to know, how do we avoid death? And so part of that was preparing for a different kind of pastor and a different kind of leadership team, and making room for those who are not yet there. And part of that preparation process, I think, has just been watching how scary it gets when worship attendance gets really low and money gets really tight, and facing generations of legacy that might indeed die. I think another way to prepare a congregation is to really help them focus on mission and vision. And I like to use Simon Sinek's Start With Why and Finding Your Why materials to do that, because it's really easy to layer in the biblical story why we do what we do and why we exist. And it helps to give us some language to call out when we're not being the church, and to really push us on to looking into practical and tangible ways that we can indeed be disciples that make disciples in our current context. And that requires that we move outside of our comfort zones. And when folks can wrap their minds around what it's going to take to be a church that is relevant and engaged in its community, then they're a little bit more ready to do some things that they wouldn't be able to do if we don't spend time defining mission and vision and why we even open the doors of the church each and every day.
That's very helpful. And I think that you're right. And I think one of the challenges, of course, for congregations is they get a vision and they don't revisit the vision. So they sort of get stuck in this pattern of, we're just going to stick with that which is familiar with us, instead of thinking about how the vision has to change as the culture around them has changed.
Yeah, you know, I think biblically Ecclesiastes reminds us that there's a season for everything. And if we just keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, that definition is insanity.
That's right.
We have to look at everything we do seasonally. Everything has a shelf life except the gospel of Jesus Christ. So it's important to key in to that. We don't do things just for the sake of doing them or just because we've done them forever. We do things because they're fruitful and they point us toward our mission and vision.
Right. And as you talk about transformation, I have to imagine for you personally, transformation took place when you started at the congregation the first time and even coming back the second time. Can you talk a little bit about your own transformation, of sort of assumptions you made that you had to let go of, or having to approach things differently? So how did you navigate that sort of transformation in your own life?
Oh, you need some really good friends.
I like that answer.
And some really safe spaces to be able to scream and cry and yell and jump up and down when you need to, but also some folks who will push back and give you some perspective. Because everything in cross-racial and cross-cultural appointments are not about race, and they're not about age. Some things are just because we as clergy haven't done a good job of holding people accountable for being actual disciples of Jesus Christ. And so when somebody can objectively look at the situation and say, I don't really think that's about you, that is very helpful. And I think another thing is that we have to be willing to be deeply reflective and deeply prayerful. Because you have to grow a really thick skin. Because a lot of the issues that happen in cross-cultural appointments happen because of lack of education and lack of accountability. And in order to do that education and to help bring a sense of accountability, you have to have some really thick skin, because people will say things to you that could destroy you if you don't have a thick skin and have a deep and abiding connection with the Holy Spirit. And that comes, I think, by just doing it. It's really hard to prepare for that. But knowing that that's what you're going to have to do as a part of the process of leading a congregation is helpful going in. And trying not to take things personally, but looking at them, you know, as a process, like we look at a lot of other different things.
And you talked earlier about sort of making space and the importance of the congregation making space for those who will come. Can you share a little bit about how at Atlanta First you all have been successful at creating space for others to join you?
Well, you know, I think it's a work in progress. Atlanta First is the delineator between downtown and midtown Atlanta, which means that in Atlanta is a city that is extraordinarily diverse, and it is also a city that's been going through gentrification for a long time. And so, you know, we have homeless friends, we have mentally ill friends, we also have CEOs and partners and chiefs of staff and all kinds of folks in our congregations and, you know, HR directors and retired teachers. And I mean, there are just a lot of different kind of people there. And that has happened because the congregation decided that it didn't want to die. And it is hard. It's very hard. And sometimes space happens intentionally, and sometimes space happens unintentionally. For instance, this summer, one of our homeless friends who was sleeping on the front steps of our church was attacked and ended up passing away. And this happened shortly after the homeless shelter, the main homeless shelter in Atlanta, closed. And he was attacked by some college students who, some alleged college students who were visiting the city, got a hold of some bad drugs and were hallucinating. And that kind of situation, it emboldens you and it gives you a sense of purpose, and it sort of even backs you into a corner to, all right, how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? Well, when those kind of conversations start, space is made. And it calls people to a different level of purpose and accountability in the way in which we're doing church. It happens through worship. We sing hymns in a lot of different ways. We sing, we do really high church, and we do really fun, flexible postmodern church. And in a traditional vein, because that's kind of our niche. And so some of it is systematic teaching and learning and preaching and planning and implementing. And some of it is by circumstance.
Well, I want to come back to the worship, but I wanted to touch on the story you just shared about the tragic death of the unhoused individual. Do you think that unfortunately too often is not until we really experience tragedy in our midst that we are really then open to doing something new, or do you think it's possible to get there without experiencing the tragedy? Because it sounds like in just a few minutes that you've shared that oftentimes it's when you're pushed against a wall that people finally say, okay, I'm willing to do something. But is it possible before they get cornered that they are open to trying something different?
It's possible. It's not easy. It takes extraordinarily spiritually mature people in leadership to want to change something that they don't see as broken. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think that's a great description, that if you don't see something as broken, then you just assume that it can continue as it is.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's the tragedy that helps the people to understand that something is actually broken.
Yeah, tragedy, stress, looking around and realizing you're sitting on your pew by yourself, wondering how long until the money runs out. There are things like that that make us sort of sit up and pay attention. But I think that there are people and places that really do believe and follow the mandates of Christ for us to be neighbors and to love our neighbors with everything that we have and everything that we are, and that they can sort of step back and say, friends, we're not doing that. But it takes really spiritually mature leaders to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. In terms of worship, you touched on what I think is a critical sort of conversation that people always struggle with, is how do we have authentic and good worship with a diverse group of people? And you talked about the fact that you do high church, but then you also do postmodern church. So how is it that you're able to sort of hold all of this together and get people to buy in to these sort of variety of ways of worshiping?
It has to be done so well that people can't complain about it, right? We have an incredibly gifted worship and music team. And worship and music has been one of the hallmarks of the life of Atlanta First through every stage in its ministry life. 160 years, there's always been excellent music there. And we have an incredible worship, music, and outreach pastor who is gifted in this way. Everybody cannot do it. You have to go sort of find the people who have the gifts and the skills for it. And he is able to bring different things into worship in such a way that all you can do is sit back and say, wow, how did you do that? And I can't believe that worked, but it was mind-blowing. And in such a way that it leads people so authentically to the heart of Jesus that even if they don't like it, they know why we're doing it. I think it's the quality. It really is the quality, the level on which it's done that makes a difference too.
So I'm going to ask a follow-up that is going to be a tough question in some ways for you to answer, but I'm hoping you can at least give it some thought. So you had the advantage of finding this perfect individual that could pull all of this together for you to make it work. So for congregations that aren't that fortunate, how do they still sort of navigate being able to do something that incorporates in sort of different ways of doing worship with knowing that they may not have that person that you have to pull off the sort of creative, innovative way of doing it?
I think that one of the best ways to do that is to interact with schools and communities. Because those schools have a pulse on what's important in that community. And if you can develop a really excellent community partnership with a school, and maybe even with that school's music department or drama department, then that partnership can inform the ways in which you plan worship. But you have to be willing to let some stuff die, and you have to be willing to listen in a way that transforms us and shapes us. It takes a level of humility that, okay, as the pastor, as the music director, as the person who leads the singing on Sunday morning, I don't know everything. And I tell my folks all the time, I have a certain wheelhouse. This is the priesthood of believers. Everybody comes with a gift. We all have to work together to make it work. And the best idea wins, not my idea, but the best idea. And we'll try just about anything for a certain period of time. Evaluate. If it didn't work, we're like, wow, we gave it a good try. And if it does work, we're like, wow, aren't we so glad that we started doing this? So you have to get outside the walls and build relationships in community and be willing to be flexible and learn some new skills.
That's a really helpful answer, because I think most people don't think about the schools as a resource in that way for the church. We usually think about the schools as a place where we go and tutor people or try to help people, but to actually think about the school can help inform the worship of the church is a helpful model for people to consider, because you're right. So all schools have usually people working together either in musicals or music department or something that can help them think differently about the way that they do worship. So thank you for
Absolutely. That.
One or two more questions to finish up. So as you move forward, how do you think you will be able to help be a resource for others around the country who are trying to do the same thing that you're doing in terms of cross-cultural ministry?
I think it's cross-cultural ministry is so contextual that it's important to not try to replicate what somebody else is doing, but to find out what's going to work in your context. And so I think as a resource, I could be most helpful just by sort of like sharing the bumps and bruises, where we hit our heads, what made me scream and holler, but was worth it. throwing around ideas and sharing the stories of what has been helpful in terms of tools and people resources and money resources and books and different training opportunities that have been helpful in this process. We're still trying to figure it out. I'm 14, 15 months into this, and we're really trying to just figure it out. And a lot of that is asking questions of people who've done it and saying, I know this sounds crazy, but is this crazy enough that it might actually work? And being willing to try the crazy thing.
And finally, you mentioned book, and I know you are the author of a fantastic book. Would you like to speak a little bit about that wonderful book?
I am the co-author of a fantastic book with the Reverend Dr. F. Douglas Poe, Jr., called Not Safe for Church, 10 Commandments for Reaching New Generations. And part of what we're doing is exactly what the book lays out in terms of how to reach new people. And so I believe that's a fantastic resource. It informs how we plan worship. It informs how we change the structure of our leadership in such a way that it's inclusive and we're listening to people who are not yet there. It informs how we invite people to worship and so much more. And so I think it could be helpful as a part of this journey as well.
Well, Reverend Smothers, we appreciate your taking the time to talk with us today, and we will be praying for you as you continue this important work.
Thank you so much.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the Engaging Local Schools Video Toolkit. More and more churches are considering how they can best support and engage their local schools, and this video toolkit guides your congregation in considering questions that are critical to the success of a school-focused service initiative. Engaging Local Schools is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. Save 20% through February 28th with coupon code TALKS. That's T-A-L-K-S. In the next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael speaks with Reverend Scott Krostick about his book, The Kaleidoscope Effect, What Emerging Generations Seek in New Leaders.
And that's where the kaleidoscope metaphor comes in beautifully, because what I find with the people under the age of 35 is that they're so quick to move, and trends change, and shifting cultures happen so rapidly that what we realize is that we need to continue to shift and adapt the same way. So kaleidoscopes are beautiful. They're timeless toys that are intended to adapt so that you can always see something new, something beautiful. They help us to see beautiful images, beautiful things. And that's kind of the way the church has to be. And so we've had all sorts of strategies to connect with our younger demographics within the congregation. And what we realize is that whatever we do, it works for a while until it doesn't. And then what we have to be willing to do is to try again, or to rotate our strategy, or to adapt what we're doing in a way that now meets people with great, nimble, strategic flexibility where they are.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.